rose and fell with the labored respiration. There was a pause, almost like a hiccup, and the breathing restarted, but irregularly now, and the flow of oxygen to the bloodstream was now diminishing. The heart rate changed, becoming yet more rapid. Then respiration ceased. The heart still didn't stop at once, so strong it was, so valiant, the doctor thought sadly, admiring this undying part of a person already dead. But that couldn't last long. And with a few final traces on the screen, it too ceased to function. The EKG machine began making a steady alarm tone. Modi reached up and shut it off. He turned to see the medics sharing a look of relief. "So soon?" the director asked, coming into the room and seeing the flat, silent line on the EKG readout. "The heart. Internal bleeding." Modi didn't have to say anything else. "I see. We are ready, then?"
"Correct, doctor."
The director motioned to the medics, who had one last job to do. One of them bundled up the plastic sheeting to contain drips. The other disconnected the last IV and the electronic EKG leads. This was done expeditiously, and when the former patient was wrapped like a piece of slaughtered meat, the locks on the wheels were kicked loose, and the two soldiers wheeled her out the door. They would return to clean the room so thoroughly as to make sure that nothing could live on the walls, floor, or ceiling. Maudi and the director followed them to Post, a room in the same confined area behind the double doors. Here was an autopsy table made of smooth, cold, stainless steel. They wheeled the treatment bed beside it, uncovering the body and rolling it to a face-down position on the steel, while the doctors observed from the corner, each donning surgical gowns over his protective suit. More from habit than necessity. Some habits are just that. Next, the plastic sheets were lifted, held by the edges to form a U-shape that allowed the accumulated blood to be poured into a container. About half a liter, the doctors estimated. The sheets were carefully carried to a large bin. The medics stuffed them in and left the room, wheeling the bin with them, off to the incinerator. Nervous as they were, it didn't appear that they'd spilled a drop anywhere.
"Very well."
The director pressed a button, and the table elevated from the far end. Out of long-standing professionalism, he touched his fingertips to the left carotid artery to make sure there was no pulse, then to the right, where again there was none. When the body was at a 20-degree angle, he took a large scalpel and cut both arteries, along with the parallel jugular veins. Blood poured out onto the table, pulled by gravity out of the body, channeled into grooves leading in turn to a drain, and over the next several minutes, 4 liters of blood were captured in a plastic container. The body went pale so quickly, Maudi saw. Moments earlier, the skin had been mottled red and purple. It seemed to fade before his eyes, or perhaps that was just imagination. A laboratory technician came to collect the blood container, which he placed on a small wheeled cart. Nobody wanted to carry something like that, even for a short distance.
"I've never posted an Ebola victim," the director observed. Not that this was a proper post-mortem examination. For all the care the director had just shown for the patient's departed humanity, bleeding her out like that, he might have slaughtered a lamb. They still had to be careful, however. In cases like this, only one pair of hands worked within the surgical field, and Maudi let the director do that, as he made rough, wide incisions. Stainless steel retractors pulled back the flaps of skin and muscle. Modi handled those, his eyes locked on the scalpel in the director's gloved hands. In another minute, the left kidney was fully exposed. They waited for the medical corpsman to return. One of them set a tray on the table next to the cadaver. Modi was revolted by what he saw next. One effect of the Ebola virus and its disease process was to break down tissue. The exposed kidney was half liquefied, and when the director reached in to remove it, the organ actually broke, pulled itself apart into two pieces like a horrid red-brown pudding. The director clucked at himself with annoyance. He'd known what to expect, but forgotten even so. Remarkable what happens to the organs, isn't it? Expect the same from the liver, but the spleen... Yes, I know. The spleen will be like a brick. Watch your hands, Modi, the director warned. He lifted a fresh retractor. The instrument was shaped rather like a scoop to remove the remaining kidney fragment. This went onto the tray. He nodded, and the medic took it off to the lab. The right kidney went more smoothly. At the director's insistence, after all the muscle and blood vessels were disconnected, both doctors used their hands to remove it, and this one stayed reasonably intact, until it landed on the tray. There the organ deformed and split open. The only good thing about it was that the softness of the tissue would not compromise the integrity of their doubled gloves. That fact didn't prevent both doctors from cringing. Here. The director flicked his hand for the orderlies to approach. Turn it over. The medics did so, one grasping the shoulders and the other the knees, flipping the body over as briskly as they could. That caused blood and some tissue to spatter on their cloth gowns. The orderlies pulled back, keeping as far away as possible. I want the liver and spleen, that's all, the director told Modi, looking up. He turned to the orderlies. Then you will wrap the body and remove it to the incinerator. This room will then be disinfected thoroughly. Sister Jean-Baptiste's eyes were open, as sightless now as they had been 30 minutes earlier. The doctor took a cloth and covered the face, murmuring a prayer for her soul, which the director heard. Yes, Modi, she is doubtless in paradise. Now shall we continue? He asked brusquely. He made the usual Y-shaped incision to open the thorax, deep and crude as before, peeling back the layers quickly, more like a meat cutter than a physician. What they saw there even shocked the director. How did she live so long like this? The man breathed. Modi thought back to his medical school days, remembering a life-sized plastic model of the human body in his first anatomy class. It was as though someone had taken the model and poured in a bucket of powerful solvent. Every exposed organ was misshapen. The surface tissue layer on most of them was dissolved. The abdomen was a sea of black blood. All they'd put in, Modi thought. Not even half of it had leaked out. Amazing. Suction, the director commanded. An orderly appeared at his side with a plastic tube leading to a vacuum bottle, and the sound of it was obscene. The process lasted fully 10 minutes, with the doctors standing back while the orderly moved the suction tube around, like a maid cleaning a house. Another 3 liters of contaminated, virus-rich blood for the lab. The body was supposed to be a temple of life, the Holy Koran taught. Modi looked down to see one transformed into... what? A factory of death, more surely than the building in which he stood. The director moved back in, and Modi watched his hands uncover the liver more carefully than before. Perhaps he'd been spooked by the blood in the abdominal cavity. Again the blood vessels were cut, the connective tissue cut away. The director set his instruments down, and without being so bidden, Modi reached in to lift out the organ and set it on the tray, which again an orderly removed. I wonder why the spleen behaves so differently. Downstairs, other medical orderlies were at work. One by one, the monkey cages were lifted from the orderly piles in the storage room. The African greens had been fed, and they were still recovering from the shock of their travel.
That somewhat reduced their ability to scratch and bite and fight the gloved hands moving the cages. But the panic of the animals returned soon enough when they arrived in another room. This part of the operation was being handled 10 at a time. Once in the killing room, when the doors were all tightly closed, the monkeys knew. The unlucky ones got to watch as one cage at a time was set on a table. The door to each was opened, and into the cage went a stick with a metal band loop on the end. The loop went over the head of each monkey and was yanked tight, usually to the faint, crackling sound of the broken neck. In every case, the animal went taut, then fell limp, usually with the eyes open and outraged at the murder. The same instrument pulled the dead animal out, and when the loop was loosened, the body was tossed to a soldier, who carried it to the next room. The others saw and screeched their rage at the soldiers, but the cages were too small to give them room to dodge. At best, one might interpose an arm in the loop, only to have that broken as well. Intelligent enough to see and know and understand what was happening to them, the African greens found it not unlike sitting in a lone tree on the savannah, watching a leopard climb up and up and up, and there was nothing they could do but screech. The noise was troublesome to the soldiers, but not that troublesome. In the next room, 5 teams of medical corpsmen worked at 5 separate tables. Clamps affixed at the neck and at the base of the tail helped keep the bodies in place. One soldier, using a curved knife, would slice open the back, tracing up the backbone, and then the other would make a perpendicular cut, pulling the hide apart to expose the inner back. The first would then remove the kidneys and hand them to the second, and while the small organs went into a special container, he would remove the body, tossing it into a plastic trash barrel for later incineration. By the time he returned to pick up his knife, the other team member would have the next monkey corpse fixed in place. It took about 4 minutes per iteration of the procedure. In 90 minutes, all the African green monkeys were dead. There was some urgency to this. All the raw material for their task was biological, and all subject to biological processes. The slaughtering crew handed off their product through double-doored openings cut into the walls, leading to the hot lab. There, things were different. Every man in the large room wore the blue plastic suit. Every motion was slow and careful. They'd been well drilled and well briefed, and what little might have been overlooked in their training had recently been recounted by the medical corpsman selected by lot to treat the Western woman upstairs in every dreadful detail. When something was carried from one place to another, an announcement was made, and people made a path. The blood was in a warming tank, and air bubbled through it. The simian kidneys, 2 large buckets of them, were taken to a grinding machine, actually not terribly different from the kind of food processor found in gourmet kitchens. This reduced the kidneys to mush, which was moved from one table to another and layered onto trays, along with some liquid nutrients. It struck more than one of the people in the lab that what they were doing was not at all unlike baking a cake or other confection. The blood was poured generously into the trays. About half was used in that way. The rest, divided into plastic containers, went into a deep freezer cooled by liquid nitrogen. The hot lab was kept warm and moist, not at all unlike the jungle. The lights were not overly bright, and shielded to contain whatever ultraviolet radiation the fluorescent might emit. Viruses didn't like UV. They needed the right environment in which to grow, and the kidneys of the African green monkey were just that, along with nutrients, proper temperature, correct humidity, and just a pinch of hate.
"You've learned so much," Dariai asked. "It's their media, their news people," Badrine explained. "They're all spies," the mullah objected. Many think so, Ali said with a smile. But they aren't really. They are... How does one explain it? Like medieval heralds. They see what they see, and they tell what they see. They are loyal to no one except themselves and their profession. Yes, it is true that they spy, but they spy on everyone, their own people most of all. It's mad, I admit, but it's true even so. Do they believe in anything? That was a hard one for his host to grasp. Another smile. Nothing that I've ever identified. Oh, yes, the American ones are devoted to Israel, but even that is an exaggeration. It took me years to understand that. Like dogs, they will turn on anyone, bite any hand, no matter how kind. They search, and they see, and they tell. And so, on this Ryan fellow, I've been able to learn everything. His home, his family, the schools his children attend, the number of the office his wife works in, everything. What if some of the information is lies? Daryai asked suspiciously. As long as he'd dealt with the West, the nature of their reporters was just too foreign to him to be fully understood. It's all easily verified. His wife's workplace, for example. I'm sure there must be some of the faithful on staff at that hospital. It's simply a matter of approaching one and asking a few harmless questions. Their home, well, that will be guarded. The same is true of the children. It's a conundrum for all such people. They must have some protection to move about, but the protection can be seen. And that tells one where they are, and who they are. Given the information I've developed, we even know where to start looking. Badrin kept his remarks short and simple. It wasn't that Daryai was a fool. He most assuredly was not. Just that he was insular. One advantage to all his years in Lebanon was that Ali had been exposed to much and had learned much. Most of all, he'd learned that he needed a sponsor. And in Mahmud Haji Daryai, he had a prospective one. This man had plans. He needed people. And, for one reason or another, he didn't fully trust his own. Badrin didn't wonder why. Whatever the reason was, it was good fortune and not to be questioned. "How well protected are such people?" the mullah asked, his hand playing with his beard. The man hadn't shaved in nearly 24 hours. "Very well indeed," Badrin replied, noting something odd about the question and filing that fact away. "American police agencies are quite effective. The crime problem in America has nothing to do with their police. They simply don't know what to do after the criminals are caught." "As applied to their president?" Ali leaned back for a stretch. "He will be surrounded by a highly trained group of expert marksmen, well motivated and utterly faithful." Badrin added these words to his presentation to see if his interlocutor's eyes changed. Daryai was weary, and there was such a change. "Otherwise, protection is protection. The procedures are straightforward. You do not need my instruction on that." "America's vulnerability?" "It's severe. Their government is in chaos. Again, you know this." "They are difficult to measure, these Americans," Daryai mused. "Their military might is formidable. Their political will is unpredictable, as someone we both knew found out to his misfortune. It is a mistake to underestimate them. America is like a sleeping lion, to be treated with care and respect." "How does one defeat a lion?" That one cut Badrin short for a second or two. Once, on a trip to Tanzania, he'd been advising the government on how to deal with insurgents. He'd gone into the bush for a day, driving with a colonel in that country's intelligence service. There he'd spotted a lion, an old one which had nonetheless managed to kill all by himself. Perhaps the wildebeest had been crippled.
Then there came into view a troop of hyenas, and, seeing that, the Tanzanian colonel had stopped the Soviet-made Zeal jeep and handed binoculars to Badrine, and told him to observe and so learn a lesson about insurgents and their capacities. It was something he'd never forgotten. The lion, he remembered, was a large one, perhaps old, perhaps slowed down from his prime, but still powerful and forbidding to behold, even from 200 meters away, a creature of undeniable magnificence. The hyenas were smaller, dog-like creatures, with their broken-back gait, an odd canter that must have been very efficient. They gathered first in a little group, 20 meters from the lion, which was trying to feed on his kill. And then the hyenas had moved, forming a circle around the lion, and whichever one was directly behind the powerful cat would move in to nip at the hindquarters, and the lion would turn and roar and dart a few meters, and that hyena would withdraw quickly. But even as that happened, another one would advance behind the lion for another nip. Individually, the hyenas would have had no more chance against this king of the grasslands than a man with a knife would have against a soldier armed with a machine gun. But try though he might, the lion could not protect his kill, nor even himself. And in just 5 minutes the lion was on the defensive, unable even to run properly, because there was always a hyena behind him, nipping at his balls, forcing the lion to run in a way that was pathetically comical, dragging his bottom on the grass as he tried to maneuver. And finally the lion just went away, without a roar, without a backward glance, while the hyenas took the kill, cackling in their odd laughing barks, as though finding amusement in their usurpation of the greater animal's labor. And so the mighty had been vanquished by the lesser. The lion would get older and weaker, and some day would be unable to defeat a real hyena attack aimed at his own flesh. Sooner or later, his Tanzanian friend had told him, the hyenas got them all. Badrine looked at his host's eyes again. It can be done. Chapter 20. New Administrations. There were 30 of them in the East Room, all men, much to his surprise, with their wives. As Jack walked into the reception, his eyes scanned the faces. Some pleased him. Some did not. Those who did were as scared as he was. It was the confident, smiling ones who worried the president. What was the right thing to do with them? Even Arnie didn't know the answer, though he had run through several approaches. Be very strong and intimidate them? Sure, Ryan thought. And tomorrow the papers would say he was trying to be King Jack the First. Take it easy. Then he'd be called a wimp, who was unable to take his proper leadership position. Ryan was learning to fear the media. It hadn't been all that bad before. As a worker bee, he'd been largely ignored. Even as Derling's national security advisor, he'd been thought of as a ventriloquist's dummy. But now the situation was very different, and there was not a single thing he could say that could not, and would not, be twisted into whatever the particular listener wanted to say himself. Washington had long since lost the capacity for objectivity. Everything was politics, and politics was ideology, and ideology came down to personal prejudices rather than the quest for truth. Where had all these people been educated that the truth didn't matter to them? Ryan's problem was that he really didn't have a political philosophy, per se. He believed in things that worked, that produced the promised results, and fixed whatever was broken. Whether those things adhered to one political slant or another was less important than the effects they had. Good ideas worked, even though some of them might seem crazy. Bad ideas didn't, even though some of them seemed sensible as hell. But Washington didn't think that way. Ideologies were facts in this city, and if the ideologies didn't work, people would deny it. And if the ones with which they disagreed did work, those who'd been opposed would never admit it, because admitting error was more hateful to them than any form of personal misconduct. They'd sooner deny God than deny their ideas. Politics had to be the only arena known to man in which people took great action without caring much for the real-world consequences, and to which the real world was far less important than whatever fantasy, right, left, or center, they'd brought to this city of marble and lawyers. Jack looked at the faces, wondering what political baggage they'd brought along with their hanging bags. Maybe it was a weakness that he didn't understand how that all worked, but for his part, he had lived a life in which mistakes got real people killed, and in Kathy's case, made people blind. For Jack, the victims were people with real names and faces. For Kathy, they were those whose faces she had touched in an operating room. For political figures, they were abstractions far more distant than their closely held ideas. "Like being in a zoo," Carolyn Ryan, FLOTUS, surgeon, observed to her husband, behind a charming smile. She'd raced home. The helicopter helped, just in time to change into a new white slinky dress and a gold necklace that Jack had bought her for Christmas. A few weeks, he remembered, before the terrorists had tried to kill her on the Route 50 bridge in Annapolis. "With golden bars," her husband, POTUS, swordsman, replied, fronting a smile of his own that was as fake as a $3 bill. "So what are we?" she asked, as the assembled senators-designate applauded their entrance. "Lion and lioness, bull and cow, peacock and peahen, or two lab bunnies waiting to have shampoo poured in our eyes?" "Depends on who's doing the beholding, baby." Ryan was holding his wife's hand, and together they walked to the microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Washington." Ryan had to pause for another round of applause. That was something else he'd have to learn. People applauded the president for damn near anything. Just as well that his bathroom had a door. He reached into his pocket and pulled out some 3x5 cards, the way presidents always kept their speaking points. The cards had been prepared by Callie Weston, and the hand printing was large enough that he didn't need his reading glasses. Even so, he'd come to expect a headache. He had one every day from all the reading. "Our country has needs, and they're not small ones. You're here for the same reason I am. You've been appointed to fill in. You have jobs which many of you never expected, and which some of you may not have wanted." This was vain flattery, but the sort they wanted to hear. More accurately, which they wanted to be seen to hear on the C-SPAN cameras in the corners of the room. There were perhaps three people in the room who were not career politicians, and one of those was a governor who'd done the me-you dance with his lieutenant governor, and so come to Washington to fill out the term of a senator from another party. That was a curveball which the papers had only started writing about. The polarity of the Senate would change as a result of the 747 crash, because the control of 32 of America's state houses hadn't quite been in line with the makeup of the Congress. "That's good," Ryan told them. "There is a long and honorable tradition of citizens in service to their nation that goes back at least as far as Cincinnatus, the Roman citizen who more than once answered his country's call, then returned to his farm and his family and his work. One of our great cities is named in memory of that gentleman," Jack added, nodding to a new senator from Ohio. His home was in Dayton, which was close enough. "You would not be here if you didn't understand what many of those needs are. But my real message for you today is that we must work together. We do not have the time, and our country does not have the time for us to bicker and fight." He had to pause for applause again. Annoyed by the delay, Ryan managed to look up with an appreciative smile and nod. "Senators, you will find me an easy man to work with. My door is always open. I know how to answer a phone, and the street goes both ways. I will discuss any issue. I will listen to any point of view. There are no rules other than the Constitution, which I have sworn to preserve, protect, and defend. The people out there where you come from, out there beyond Interstate 495, expect all of us to get the job done. They don't expect us to get reelected. They expect us to work for them to the best of our ability. We work for them. They don't work for us. We have the duty to perform for them. Robert E. Lee once said that duty is the most sublime word in our language. It's even more sublime and even more important now because none of us has been elected to our offices. We represent the people of a democracy. But in every case, we have come here in a way that simply wasn't supposed to happen. How much greater, then, is our personal duty to fulfill our roles in the best possible manner? More applause. There is no higher trust than that which fate has conferred on us. We are not medieval noblemen blessed by birth with high station and great power. We are the servants, not the masters, to those whose consent gives us what power we have. We live in the tradition of giants. Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, John Calhoun, and so many other members of your House of the Congress must be your models. How stands the Union? Webster is said to ask from his grave. We will determine that. The Union is in our hands. Lincoln called America the last and best hope of mankind, and in the past 20 years America has given truth to that judgment by our 16th president. America is still an experiment, a collective idea, a set of rules called the Constitution to which all of us, within and without the Beltway, give allegiance. What makes us special is that brief document. America isn't a strip of dirt and rock between two oceans. America is an idea and a set of rules we all follow. That's what makes us different. And in holding true to that, we in this room can make sure that the country we pass on to our successors will be the same one entrusted to us, maybe even a little bit improved. And now, Ryan turned to the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the 4th Judicial Circuit, the nation's most senior appellate judge, up from Richmond. It's time for you to join the team. Judge William Staunton came to the microphone. Every senatorial spouse held a Bible, and every senatorial appointee placed his left hand on it, raising the other. I, state your name. As Ryan watched, the new senators were duly sworn. At least it looked solemn enough. The oaths were spoken. A few of the new legislators kissed the Bibles, either from personal religious conviction or because they were close to the cameras. Then they kissed their wives, most of whom beamed. There was a collective intake of breath, and then they all looked around at one another, and the White House staff came into the room with drinks just after the cameras were turned off, because now the real work started. Ryan got himself a glass of Perrier and walked into the middle of the room, smiling despite his fatigue and his unease at performing political duties. The photos came in one more time. Security at Khartoum Airport had not improved, and this time 3 American intelligence officers were snapping photos of the people walking down the stairs. Everyone around was surprised that no news people had yet twigged to the story. A stream of official cars, probably the entire complement for this poor nation, ferried the visitors away. When the process was complete, the 737 airliner went back east, and the spooks drove off to the embassy. 2 others of their number were camped out at the dwellings assigned to the Iraqi generals. This tidbit had come from the station chief's contact in the Sudanese Foreign Ministry. When those photos had been taken, the additional officers also drove back, and in the embassy darkroom the frames were processed, blown up, and faxed off via satellite. At Langley, Bert Vasco identified every face, assisted by a pair of CIA desk officers and a set of mugshots in the CIA files. "That's it," the State Department officer pronounced. "That's the whole military leadership. But not one civilian out of the Ba'at party." "So, we know who the sacrificial goats are." That observation came from Ed Foley. "Yep," Mary Pat answered with a nod. "And it gives a chance for the senior surviving officers to arrest them, process them, and show loyalty to the new regime." "Shit," she concluded. "Too fast." Her station chief in Riyadh was all dressed up with no place to go. The same was true of some Saudi diplomats who'd hastily put together a program of fiscal incentives for the notional new Iraqi regime. It would now be unnecessary. Ed Foley, the new DCI designate, shook his head in admiration. "I didn't think they had it in 'em. Killing our friend, sure, but coaxing the leadership out this fast and this smooth? Who would have thunk it?" "You got me there, Mr. Foley," Vasco agreed. "Somebody must have brokered the deal. But who?" "Get buzzin', worker bees," Ed Foley told the desk officers with a wry smile. "Everything you can develop, ASAP." It looked like some sort of awful stew, the darkened human blood and the red-brown nephritic mush of monkey kidneys, just sitting there, marinating in flat, shallow glass trays under dim lights shielded to keep ultraviolet light from harming the viruses. There wasn't much to do at this point except to monitor the environmental conditions, and simple analog instruments did that. Moody and the director walked in, wearing their protective garb, to check the sealed culturing chambers for themselves. Two-thirds of Jean-Baptiste's blood was now deep frozen in case something went wrong with their first effort at reproducing the Ebola Mayinga virus. They also checked the room's multi-stage ventilation systems, because now the building was truly a factory of death. The precautions were double-sided. As in this room they strove to give the virus a healthy place to multiply, just outside the door the Army medical corpsmen were spraying every square millimeter to make sure that it was the only such place. And so the virus had to be isolated and protected from the disinfectant as well. Thus the air drawn into the culture chambers had to be carefully filtered, lest in their effort to stay alive the people in the building killed that which might kill them if they made another sort of mistake.
"So you really think this version might be airborne?"
"As you know, the Ebola Zaire Mayinga strain is named for a nurse who became infected despite all conventional protective measures. Patient 2," he had decided it was easier not to speak her name, "was a skilled nurse with Ebola experience. She did not give any injections, and she didn't know how she might have contracted the virus. Therefore, yes, I believe this is possible."
"That would be very useful, Moody," the director whispered, so faintly that the junior physician had trouble hearing it. He heard it even so. The thought alone was loud enough. "We can test for it," the older man added.
That would be easier on him, Moody thought. At least he wouldn't know those people by name. He wondered if he was right about the virus. Might patient 2 have made a mistake and forgotten it? But no, he had examined her body for punctures, as had Sister Maria Magdalena, and it wasn't as though she might have licked secretions from the young Benedict Macusa, was it? So what did that have to mean? It meant that the Mayinga strain survived for a brief period of time in air, and that meant they had a potential weapon such as man had never before encountered, worse than nuclear weapons, worse than chemical weapons. They had a weapon which could reproduce itself and be spread by its own victims, one to another and another, until the disease outbreak burned out in due course. It would burn out. All the outbreaks did. It had to burn out, didn't it? didn't it? Moody's hand came up to rub his chin. A contemplative gesture stopped short by the plastic mask. He didn't know the answer to that one. In Zaire and the few other African countries afflicted by this odious disease, the outbreaks, frightening though they were, all did burn out, despite the ideal environmental conditions which protected and sustained the virus strands. But on the other side of that equation was the primitive nature of Zaire, the horrible roads and the absence of efficient transport. The disease killed people before they could get far. Ebola wiped out villages, but did little more. But nobody really knew what would happen in an advanced country. Theoretically, one could infect an aircraft, say an international flight into Kennedy. The travelers would leave one aircraft and fan out into others. Maybe they'd be able to spread the disease through coughs and sneezes immediately, or maybe not. It didn't matter, really. Many of them would fly again in a few days, wondering if they had the flu, and then they'd be able to communicate the virus and so infect more. The question of how an epidemic spread was one of time and opportunity more than anything else. The more rapidly it got out from the focal center, and the more rapid the instrumentalities of travel, the farther a disease could spread laterally through a population. There were mathematical models, but they were all theoretical, dependent on a multitude of individual variables, each of which could affect the entire threat equation by at least one order of magnitude. To say the epidemic would die out in time was correct. The question was, how fast? That would determine the number of people infected before protective measures took effect. 1% invasion of a society, or 10%, or 50%. America wasn't a provincial society. Everyone interacted with everyone else. A truly airborne virus with a 3-day incubation period, there was no model for that known to Moody. The deadliest recent Zairean outbreak in Kikwit had claimed fewer than 300 lives, but it had started with one unfortunate woodcutter, then his family, then their neighbors. The trick, then, if you wanted to create a much wider outbreak, was to increase the number of index cases. If you could do that, the initial blossoming of Ebola Zaire Mayinga America could be so large as to invalidate conventional control measures. It would spread not from one man and one family, but from hundreds of individuals and families. Or thousands? Then the next generational leap could involve hundreds of thousands. About this time, the Americans would realize that something evil was afoot. But there would be time for one more generational leap, and that would be an order of magnitude greater still, perhaps into the millions. At that point, medical facilities would be overwhelmed. And there might be no stopping it at all. Nobody knew the possible consequences of a deliberate mass infection in a highly mobile society. The implications might be truly global, but probably not. Almost certainly not, Moody judged, looking down at the glass culture trays behind thick wire glass panels, through the plastic of his mask. The first generation of this disease had come from an unknown host and killed a young boy. The second generation had claimed but a single victim due to fate and luck and his own competence as a physician. The third generation would grow before his eyes. How far that might spread was undetermined. But it was generations 4, 5, 6, and perhaps even 7, which would determine the fate of an entire country, which happened to be the enemy of his own. It was easier now. Jean-Baptiste had had a face and a voice and a life which had touched his own. He could not make that mistake again. She'd been an infidel, but a righteous one, and she was now with Allah, because Allah was truly merciful. He'd prayed for her soul, and surely Allah would hear his prayers. Few in America or elsewhere could possibly be as righteous as she had been, and he knew well that Americans hated his country and distrusted his religious faith. They might have names and faces, but he didn't see them here, and he never would. And they were all 10,000 kilometers away, and it was easy to switch the television off.
Yes, Moody agreed. Testing for it will be easy enough.
Look, George Winston was telling a knot of 3 new senators, if the federal government made cars, a Chevy pickup would cost $80,000 and have to stop every 10 blocks to fill up the tank. You guys know business. So do I. We can do better.
Is it really that bad? The alphabetically senior senator from Connecticut asked.
I can show you the comparative productivity numbers. If Detroit ran this way, we'd all be driving Japanese cars, Winston replied, jabbing his finger into the man's chest, and reminding himself to get rid of his Mercedes 500 SEL, or at least garage it for a while. It's like having one cop car to cover East L.A., Tony Brattano was saying to 5 more, 2 of them from California. I don't have the forces I need to cover one MRC. That's major regional conflict, he explained to the new people and their spouses. And we're supposed to, on paper I mean, we're supposed to be able to cover 2 of them at the same time, plus a peacekeeping mission somewhere else, okay? Now, what I need at defense is a chance to reconfigure our forces so that the shooters are the most important, and the rest of the outfit supports them, not the other way around. Accountants and lawyers are useful, but we have enough of them at Treasury and Justice. My side of the government, we're the cops, and I don't have enough cops on the street.
But how do we pay for that? Colorado, the younger, asked.
The senior senator from the Rocky Mountain State had been at a fundraiser in Golden that night.
The Pentagon isn't a jobs program. We have to remember that. Now, next week I'll have a full assessment of what we need, and then I'm going to come to the Hill, and together we'll figure how to make that happen at the least possible cost.
See, what did I tell you? Arnie Van Dam said quietly, passing behind Ryan's back.
Let them do it for you. You just stay pleasant.
What you said was right, Mr. President, the new senator from Ohio professed to believe, sipping a bourbon and water now that the cameras were off. You know, once in school I did a little history paper on Cincinnatus, and... Well, all we have to do is remember to put the country first, Jack told him. How do you manage to do your job and... I mean, the wife of the senior senator from Wisconsin explained, you still do your surgery? And teaching, which is even more important, Kathy said with a nod, wishing she were upstairs and doing her patient notes. Well, there was the helicopter ride in tomorrow. I will never stop doing my work. I give blind people their sight back. Sometimes I take the bandages off myself, and the look on their faces is the best thing in the world. The best, she repeated. Even better than me, honey? Jack asked, placing his arm around her shoulder. This might even be working, he thought. Charm them, Arnie and Callie had told him. The process had already started. The colonel assigned to guard the 5 mullahs had followed them into the mosque, where, moved by the moment, he'd worshipped with them. At the conclusion of the devotions, the senior of their number had spoken to him, quietly and politely, touching on a favored passage in the Holy Quran, so as to establish some common ground. It brought to the colonel a memory of his youth and his own father, a devout and honorable man. It was the usual thing in dealing with people, no matter the place or the culture. You got them talking, read their words, and chose the proper path for continuing the conversation. The mullah, a member of the Iranian clergy for over 40 years, had counseled people on their faith and on their troubles for all that time. And so it was not hard for him to establish a rapport with his captor, a man supposedly sworn to kill him and his 4 colleagues should those orders arrive from his superiors. But in picking a man deemed faithful, the departing generals had chosen a little too wisely, because men who display true loyalty are men of thoughts and principles, and such men are ever vulnerable to ideas demonstrably better than those to which they adhere. There could be no real contest. Islam was a religion with a long and honorable history, neither of which attribute attached to the dying regime which the colonel had sworn to uphold.
"It must have been a hard thing fighting in the swamps," the mullah told him a few minutes later, as the conversation turned to relations between the two Islamic countries.
"War is evil. I never took pleasure in killing," the colonel admitted.
It was rather like being a Catholic in the confessional, and all at once the man's eyes teared up, and he related some of the things he'd done over the years. He could see now that while he'd never taken such pleasure, he had hardened his heart to it, finally not distinguishing the innocent from the guilty, the just from the corrupt, and done what he'd been told, because he'd been told, not because it had been in any way the right thing to do. He saw that now.
"Man falls often, but through the words of the Prophet we may always find our way back to a merciful God. Men are forgetful of their duties, but Allah is never forgetful of His."
The mullah touched the officer's arm.
"I think your prayers are not finished this day.
Together we will pray to Allah, and together we will find peace for your soul."
After that, it had been very easy indeed. On learning that the generals were even now leaving the country, the colonel had two good reasons for cooperating. He had no wish to die. He was quite willing to follow the will of his God in order to stay alive and serve. In demonstration of his devotion, he assembled two companies of soldiers to meet with the mullahs and get their orders. It was very easy for the soldiers. All they had to do was follow the orders of their officers. To do anything else was a thought that never occurred to any of them. It was now dawn in Baghdad, and at a score of large houses doors were kicked in. Some occupants they found awake. Some were drunkenly asleep. Some were packed to leave, and trying to figure a place to go and a way to get there. All were a little too late in their understanding of what was going on around them, in a place where a minute's error was the difference between prosperous life and violent death. Few resisted, and the one man who came closest to doing so successfully was cut nearly in half by a 20-round burst from an AK-47, along with his wife. Mostly they were led barefoot from their homes into waiting trucks, heads down to the sidewalk, knowing the way this particular drama would end for them. These tactical radio nets were not encrypted, and the faint VHF signals were monitored, this time at storm track, which was closer to Baghdad. Names were spoken more than once in every case as the pickup teams reported back to their dispatchers, which made life easy for the Elent teams close to the border and at King Khalid Military City. The watch officers called in their supervisors, and critic priority dispatches were shot off via satellite. Ryan had just walked the last of the new senators to the door when Andrea Price walked up.
"My shoes are killing me, and I have a procedure at..."
Kathy stopped talking.
"Flash traffic coming in now, sir."
"Iraq?" Jack asked.
"Yes, Mr. President."
The President kissed his wife.
"I'll be up in a little while."
Kathy had no choice but to nod and head to the elevator, where one of the ushers was waiting to take the first couple upstairs. The kids would already be in bed. Their homework was all done, probably in some cases with the help of their bodyguards. Jack turned right, trotted down the stairs, then right again, left to get outside of the building, then back inside the West Wing and the Situation Room.
"Talk to me," the President commanded.
"It started," Ed Foley's face said on the wall-mounted TV, and all they could do was watch. Iraqi national television greeted a new day and a new reality. This was clear when the newsreaders commenced their daily presentation with an invocation of Allah's name, not for the first time, but never with this degree of fervor.
Give me that old-time religion. It's good enough for me. Now, observed the chief master sergeant at Palm Bowl, because the transmission was national, and repeated from the transmitters in nearby Basra. He turned and waved.
Major Sabah?
Yes, chief, yes, the Kuwaiti officer replied with a nod as he came over.
He hadn't had much in the way of doubt before. His superiors had expressed reservations. They always did. They were never quite as close to the pulse of their enemy as the major was, thinking politics instead of ideas.
He checked his watch. They'd be in their offices in 2 hours after the normal morning routine, and that didn't matter now. Hurrying wouldn't change anything. The dam had broken, and the water would spill out. The time to stop it had passed, assuming that such a chance had ever existed.
The Iraqi military had taken over, the TV news broadcast said. This was announced as though the situation were unique. A Council of Revolutionary Justice had been formed. Those guilty of crimes against the people, a good catch-all term which meant very little but was understood by all, were being arrested and would face the judgment of their countrymen. The nation needed calm most of all, the TV told them. Today would be a national holiday. Only those in essential public service jobs were expected to go to work. For the rest of the country's citizens, it was advised that they consider this a day of prayer and reconciliation. For the rest of the world, the new regime promised peace. The rest of the world would have all day to think about that.
Daryai had already done a good deal of thinking about it. He'd managed 3 hours of sleep before awakening for morning prayers. He found that as he aged he needed less and less. Perhaps the body understood that. With little time remaining, there was no longer time for rest, though there was for dreams, and he'd dreamed of lions in the early hours of this day. Dead lions. The lion had also been the symbol of the Shah's regime, and truly Badrain had been correct. Lions could be killed. The real ones had once been native to Iran, Persia in the old style, and had been hunted down to extinction in classical times. The symbolic ones, the Pahlavi dynasty, had similarly been eradicated with a combination of patience and ruthlessness. He'd played a role in that. It hadn't always been pretty. He'd ordered and supervised an atrocity, the firebombing of a crowded theater filled with people more interested in Western decadence than their Islamic faith. Hundreds had died horribly. But it had been necessary. A needed part of the campaign to bring his country and his people back to the true path. And while he regretted that particular incident, and regularly prayed in atonement for the lives taken, no, he didn't regret it. He was an instrument of the faith, and the Holy Quran itself told of the need for war, holy war, in defense of the faith. Another gift of Persia, some said India, to the world, was the game of chess, which he had learned as a child. The very word for the end of the game, checkmate, came from the Persian shahmat, the king is dead, something he had himself helped to achieve in real life. And while Daryai had long since stopped playing mere games, he remembered that a good player thought not move by move, but four or even more moves ahead. One problem with chess, as with life, was that the next move could sometimes be seen, especially when the other player was skilled. To assume him to be anything else could be dangerous. But by playing ahead, it was far more difficult to see what was coming, until the very end, at which point the opponent could see clearly, but, maneuvered out of position, depleted of his players, power, and options, he had no choice but to resign the game. Such had been the case in Iraq until this morning. The other player, actually many of them, had resigned and run away, and Daryai had been pleased to allow it. It was even more delicious when the other player could not run. But the point was winning, not satisfaction, and winning meant thinking farther and faster than the other player, so that the next move was a surprise, so that the other player was harried and confused, would be forced to take time to react,
and in a chess match, as in life, time was limited. It was all a thing of the mind, not the body. So it was with lions, it would seem.